Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 110. In this episode, we talk about two articles from Laura Edelman concerning the intersection of organizations and law. Both were published in the American Journal of Sociology. The first is Legal Ambiguity and Symbolic Structures, Organizational Mediation of Civil Rights Law, published in 1992. And the second is The Endogeneity of Legal Regulation, Grievance Procedures as Rational Myth, with Christopher Uggen and Howard Erlinger in 1999. To learn more about the texts, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Hi, this is Tom from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hi, and this is Pedro Monteiro from a chilly evening in Copenhagen. And I'm glad to introduce our guest for this episode, the wonderful Laura Adler, who is an assistant professor of organizational behavior at the Yale School of Management. Welcome, Laura. We are delighted to have you here.
Thank you so much, Pedro. Thank you, Tom, for having me. So yes, I'm Laura, and I am calling from New York in the United States. As Pedro mentioned, I'm an assistant professor of organizational behavior at the Yale School of Management. And I'm very excited today to talk about Lauren Edelman's work, which has really had such a profound influence on my own theoretical creativity, her methodological doggedness in the face of often limited empirical data on these challenging issues. These are things that have inspired me and have also been a model for me as I've tried to do my own historical research on the development of human resources practices. So I'm generally interested in workplace inequality and particularly the idea of meritocracy and the role of valuation or how we come to value people's work, including the subtle influence of status on gender inequality. But my dissertation is what really brought me into close contact with Edelman's work. The backstory of my dissertation is that in around 2017, I became curious about how organizations set pay for their workers. It was a period of extremely low unemployment, so it was really hard for people to find workers, but wages weren't rising. Wages had stagnated for a long time, and they were not ticking up at all. The fact that there was this mismatch between the supply-demand dynamic and the pricing led me as an organizational scholar to think about how organizations make these decisions. Doing so, I leveraged this new law in the U.S. known as the salary history ban, which prohibited employers from asking job candidates about their previous pay. And what I found was that employers were really stuck on the use of salary history and pay setting. Basically, they had these big, broad ranges for a job, but when it came time to set pay for an individual, they were reliant basically exclusively on that individual's own past pay. And so I began to look at the origins of contemporary pay practices in the United States. And I found a really surprising story, which was that organizations used to set pay in this very bureaucratic practice and at some point shifted to a market-based practice to setting pay, really rooted in this salary history idea. And I thought that this might be because of deunionization, or it might be because of technological change or the changing employment relationship. But instead, what I found is this increasing anxiety in the 1970s and 80s about the definition of gender pay inequality under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, so exactly the law that we're going to be talking about today. And I found that the courts basically created this opening for organizations by saying, insofar as pay is based on the external market, it's not actually the organization's responsibility if any inequality results from that. If the organization is making all the pay decisions as they had under the bureaucratic approach, then they're liable for that inequality. But if the pay arises from the external market, then it's not the organization's fault. And so, of course, this led me directly into contact with Edelman's work, right? This surprising response of organizations to new legal pressures and the ways in which their responses become institutionalized and ultimately end up entrenching inequalities. And so I'm very excited to talk about Edelman's work today. It is such an inspiration for me, as I said at the beginning, and I'm eager to hear what you guys thought of it.
Okay, so we have two articles. that we're going to review from Lauren Adelman, who at the time that this episode is going to be released is 1 year, almost to the day of her passing. She has been an inspiration for quite a number of scholars. Her background is in the intersection of organizations and law, and that is the primary subject of the two articles that we're going to look at. 1992's Legal Ambiguity and Symbolic Structures, Organizational Mediation of Civil Rights Law, that covers how organizations respond to the introduction of new laws. And then the second one, there's three authors. This is Lauren Adelman with Christopher Uggen and Howard S. Erlinger. And this is from 1999. The Endogeneity of Legal Regulation, Grievance Procedures as Rational Myth. And this is an article that looks at how grievance procedures become a driver of change and enforcement of these legal structures. Laura, we'll give you the first word. Why don't you go ahead and give us just a real quick overview of the two articles, and then we'll dive into the details.
Great. Yeah. So across these two articles, I really think that Adelman is developing a really rich institutional theory of how organizations respond to the law. So she wants to help us understand how organizations are shaped by their legal environments and specifically the need for legitimacy, but also give space to the idea of organizational agency. So she wants to understand how internal factors, the drive for efficiency, the desire to maintain the status quo or maintain managerial discretion, how those internal factors and the agency organizations have interacts with the external influence of the law to produce what ends up being the legal norms that become taken for granted. And the first article looks at how they become taken for granted within organizations. And the second article is great because it brings it back to the law and shows how these strategies of compliance that organizations construct themselves in response to the law end up becoming institutionalized in the law itself and therefore become a force for market rationality, right? It doesn't start out being rational for organizations to do this. It starts out being socially constructed, but it ends up being rational insofar as the courts accept these explanations. The first article looks at how organizations respond to two different legal influences, but primarily Title VII of the Civil Rights Act from 1964, which says that organizations cannot discriminate against people on the basis of race, sex, nationality, religion, and other factors. But it fails to define discrimination or set out what compliance is going to look like. And so she looks at how organizations invent compliance strategies in the face of this lack of direction. And the second article, several years later, looks at how then a specific kind of policy that organizations construct, which is the policy of grievance procedures, how it's first invented, and then how it becomes taken up by the courts, and how the courts, although it wasn't originally the way the courts anticipated organizations responding, it becomes accepted by the courts and therefore becomes an efficient thing for organizations to do. So I like that these two articles sort of give us the whole trajectory, right, from the law to organizations and back to the law again.
Very interesting. So you and Tom already started to touch on the overall goal of the articles, right, and what they have in common. I think it may be also interesting to say that Adelman basically bases the first article on a survey of different organizations, right? And in the second, she complements that with another, you know, follow-up and, of course, also analysis of the professional discourse and the legal documents, because in that case, she's looking at comparison, contrasting of what was the idea that existed around grievance procedures and how they were promoted versus what is actually was happening in organizations and what was happening in the law. There is, as you said, as well, this parallel in which she's trying to see the intersection and interaction between law, organization, professions, taking this more institutional theory and updating that as well. But I think that one place to start, given the focus of the papers and the theorizing, is what are the characteristics of this law that she's studying, right? Which is something she opens the first paper and hints at the second paper as well, which seems to position some conditions to what seems to be happening. And from what I can see on my list, she lists three conditions in which she talks about the organizational mediation of law. And she talks about the ambiguity on the meaning of compliance, the definition of discrimination, and so on the potential procedural emphasis, because exactly given the ambiguity on whether the law is focusing anti-discrimination in terms of procedure or substantive interpretation one can have about that, given the lack of clear definition. So a procedural emphasis can dominate, right? And also the weak enforcement mechanisms that such law seems to have, right? Which seems to be an important reason that create more space and opportunities for this work. In the first paper, we see of organizations. And in the second paper, we see more of the professional groups of personnel and HR and anti-discrimination officers operate and translate particular objectives into actual organizational processes.
Yeah, exactly. So those three factors, I think, are super important and also theoretically really interesting, I think. You know, the first factor, as you said, was vague language or ambiguity, right? And you pointed out already, I still find this the most striking thing, one of the most striking things about the paper. The law, the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, includes 11 definitions or something like that. None of those definitions are of the word discriminate, right? So the focus of the law is to make it illegal to discriminate, and it never defines what discrimination is. But sort of on a more sort of legal level, I think it's also worth drawing out a little bit what the legal ambiguity here is. So on the one hand, non-discrimination may imply equality of treatment, right? So everybody should be treated the same, regardless of their race, gender, et cetera. On the other hand, it may imply equality of outcome. And equality of outcome, guaranteeing that Black applicants have a representative chance of getting the job, representative of their prevalence in the population, would require actually differential treatment, right? So we have, on the one hand, an imperative for equality of treatment, on the other, of differential treatment with the aim of getting to equality of outcome. And so there is a deep ambiguity and tension in the definition of these laws. And this is one of the ambiguities that allows organizations to mediate the impact by interpreting the law in ways that are favorable to themselves. I think the emphasis on procedure, the second factor that you pointed out, similarly picks up on this question of equal opportunity versus representation, right? So we're only saying that organizations have to do certain things, not that they have to achieve certain outcomes, right? And that, again, leaves open. If you have outcomes, then you have an objective thing where you can actually evaluate whether the organization did what they were supposed to do. But if you just have procedures, then that leaves open a lot more ambiguity. And lastly, on weak enforcement, we have enforcement here, as in many domains in the US, enforcement is via complaint, right? And I just wanted to point out a couple of data points, right? So I'm currently working on a project using data from the EEOC. And I can see in that data that the vast majority of cases result in a no cause finding, but well over 90% of cases. And so you can bring a case to the EEOC, it will almost always result in nothing for you. For the people that do then pursue a lawsuit, it's expensive, and they end up being alienated from their workplace and their colleagues, people, the plaintiffs. And they rarely win. So there's a fabulous book called Rights on Trial by Ellen Berry, Laura Beth Nielsen, and Robert Nelson that shows the sort of pathetic number of plaintiffs who actually win and how little money they actually receive, even if they do win. I think the median is about $30,000. And in the meanwhile, they've typically lost their job. And so this weak enforcement, it's truly so weak, right? The burden is on the worker to try and enforce the law, and they really have very few tools with which to accomplish that.
And I would also add that it is important to recognize that she's writing this almost... although there's a lot of generalizability to this, the topic area is very specifically equal opportunity and affirmative action legislation. After we discuss the articles, we'll talk a little bit more about how generalizable these ideas are in other legal issue domains, because there's certainly these three do have a lot of commonality with other types of legal discussions. Then afterwards, she gets into the process by which organizations mediate the law, which is to say how they respond, structurally and through institutionalization. And I'll just sort of read this one sentence from 1542, page 1542. Organizations respond visibly to law by elaborating their formal structures. And I use the term formal structures to refer to the configuration of offices and positions and the formal linkages between them, as well as to the formal rules, programs, positions, and procedures. Visibly is the word I underlined there, because that naturally lends one to think about doing something to be seen as doing something. You create an office by which you dedicate a person, a billet, you know, however you describe it, and there you go. There's somebody who is responsible and hopefully is given the authorities and responsibilities there too, which kind of gets to the institutionalization side. And she talks about, there was a sentence, so once law motivates organizations that are sensitive to their legal environments to devise symbols of compliance, the personnel and affirmative action professions together with the courts help to convey, rationalize, and institutionalize these models of compliance. Which is to say that if one organization sets up an EEO office, then the question becomes, what about everybody else? What are do organizations who not do this, are they not following or not getting on board, not getting with the idea? And this gets right to actually Meyer, the episode we just recently did on Meyer and Rowan, where in general, structures become institutionalized. And that kind of takes us to the second article.
So it's interesting you talked about the specificity, right, of the law in the context and how that leads to the theorizing. And we can unpack that a little bit more. But I think exactly in bringing institutional theory, which we recently discussed, Tom, right, in the podcast, showcases exactly that, right? Especially in the first article, she's trying to show that the reason of particular structures are symbolic. It's about legitimacy. I mean, there's also practical reasons in terms of, you know, promises of avoiding litigation and so on. But there is this idea that they are meant to purvey the idea that organizations are doing something about that, right? And of course, as you said, there is something about, we may expect a particular social expectation given the nature of this topic. She also talks about a little bit about the coupling, right, on how actually such structures may not necessarily be connected to personnel and governance activities, right, which is also something that we know from institutional theory. In the second paper, she expands a little bit more our understanding of institutional theory, but in this one is more about using such idea. But what's interesting here is that exactly as we're hinting, she then uses that to look at different types of organizational structures, right? Getting more specific, and also the patterns in which the adoption of particular structures happens across different types of organizations in particular conditions around their centrality and connection to the public sphere, as she calls it, which basically means the state, right? The linkages to the federal government, the size of the organization, the presence of HR departments, the geographical location, the legal experience, the presence of unions in the location, and so on, a variety of different conditions. But I think that is exactly where the paper gives us, beyond great insights on this particular case, also some ways of understanding the intersection of law and organization, because it's trying to look at the ways in which organizations have potentially different ways to respond and constructing structures in a particular way, and trying to understand what we may expect given such different conditions in which they are operating.
Yeah, so I think you're getting at the hypothesis, the empirical dimension of the paper, where she's laying out where we would expect to see more compliance. Just to give people an overview, she advances the argument that compliance that is less costly, so implementing policies, will diffuse more quickly than compliance that is more costly, like instituting an EEO office. And she says that organizations that are more sensitive to the legal environment will adopt more quickly. So her examples include proximity to the public sector, particularly federal contractors, size, the presence of an HR department. She calls HR departments windows to the legal environment, which I love. Unionization, which could theoretically cut both ways, but in the end ends up facilitating more adoption of these policies. So yeah, I think she has a rich empirical argument in this paper I do think she's also, though, pushing us a little further than Meyer and Rowan, not just sort of implementing what they've advanced, but also sort of helping us understand at a theoretical level more about what's going on in the institutionalization of these rational myths. And what I find so compelling about her framework is what she calls the dilemma. And the dilemma is that there's this tension between the imperative to demonstrate your compliance in order to maintain that external legitimacy and the internal resistance that organizations have. They want minimal disruption to the status quo. They want to resist encroachment on managerial discretion, and they want to limit practices that are irrational. So again, this is where she's bringing agency back into that institutional model proposed by Meyer and Rowan, saying it's not just about legitimacy and myths. It is also about how organizations are strategically attempting to navigate this dilemma. And as Tom pointed out, the solution they come up with is to construct these very visible symbols of compliance, which she argues maximize both of those interests, sort of joint interests there.
Yeah, and I also highlighted the at the end, I wasn't going to get into the specific methodology of the empirical part. I mean, she did do all of these tests. And in the end, at the what she includes at the end of the discussion, organizations elaborate their structures to demonstrate attention to the law. So she proved that through the empirical test. But there are important differences among organizations, both in the timing of their responses and in the types of the symbolic structures that they create. Those most sensitive to their normative environments are the innovators of structural responses and more likely to create high investment EEO affirmative action structures. And as societal approval, and this I thought was the really interesting finding to me, as societal approval for EEO affirmative action in employment increases, and as it becomes apparent that those structures have some advantages for the governance of employees, these structures help to erode managerial resistance to EEO affirmative action law. This engenders a second wave of structural elaboration. And I thought that was interesting because that, we were talking about going from the law to organizations back to the law. This also highlights the role society has as a player in what becomes accepted, what becomes understood as legitimate or not. And so when she's talking about the second wave of structural elaboration, that's, okay, now that we've institutionalized a set of approaches that seem to have gotten legs and people are expecting, now society garners these expectations and they go back to the organization. So then societies start demanding, well, if you're not an EEO compliant type of an organization, if you don't have your certified expert on the staff, then I'm not going to come work for you, or I'm not going to encourage others to go work for you, or whatever. That conclusion really sort of brought it all home, and it kind of sets the stage for talking about then what happens when these procedures or this elaboration gets implemented. And we start getting into grievance, how individuals enact the new structures.
Yeah, and I just wanted to highlight before we jump into the second article, a little bit of the societal background that's going on here. She doesn't really touch on it directly, and people in the United States, particularly maybe older people, might just be familiar with this from life experience, but there might be people listening who aren't so familiar. These laws that organizations are responding to are the culmination of the civil rights movement in the US in legislative form. So the civil rights movement, obviously ongoing throughout the 60s, finally in 1964, the Civil Rights Act is the big legislative coup for that movement. This is a time when finally the civil rights movement is having some sort of direct effect on what organizations can and can't do. At the same time, there's the beginning of a major backlash that will then persist throughout the next two decades, you know, throughout the Reagan period, where civil rights law is essentially not enforced, which says, you know, there's too much incursion into organizational practices, and we should not have to respond to these demands for diversity or non-discrimination. You know, we see the legacy of that backlash today in the anti-affirmative action rulings that we just experienced from the Supreme Court. And so what the organizational dynamics that she's observing are sort of throughout the 70s and 80s at the confluence of those two factors, right? The achievements of the Civil Rights Act and the backlash that quickly followed.
So I don't know if it's a good way to start with the second paper, but I'll try, because one of the advantages of thinking together is that sometimes you say something and then someone says something and you realize, well, that's actually not what I wanted to say. So I really agree with you, Laura, when you said that there is an extension of Maya Roman also in this paper, right? And she was talking about on how she's bringing back the strategic agency that organizations can have. And already in this paper, but even more in the second one, there is also an attempt to transform what it seems to usually has been perceived as a duality, as an opposition between responses that are more about rationality and efficiency versus legitimacy, actually coexist. And actually can be, they can coexist in different time scales, in different geographic or social spaces, and can also be intertwined. And I think to some extent, in the first article, we see a little bit of that, and Tom was referring to that, right? That to some extent, as this practice become taken for granted, as they become understood as important, then they become also understood as not just as a matter of legitimacy, but also the way how we should run such organization in a particular way, what it is, you know, an operational, effective way to manage such concern. And she talks exactly about rules and, you know, versus offices and how rules are, you know, less costly. And that's why it becomes so taken for granted and used and provides an actionable tool, right, to manage such concern. And of course, in the second paper, she does even more of that, because she starts by looking at the case in which, besides the law in itself, you know, she talks about ideologies of rationality, right, which are the accounts, stories, and myths about how organizations should respond to the law, right? So not just the law in the books, but, you know, when I was reading that, I imagined almost the social life of the law, the ideas that professionals and organizations and even the courts themselves have about what is acceptable, desirable, and so on, right? So that's what she's trying to get at this paper, and she's trying to look at the interaction again at even a broader scale here, one may say, between not just the organizations and the law, but also bringing the professions into the picture as well. And one of the arguments is going to be exactly on how some ideas that existed, or we call it stories, about what would be actionable tool to respond to such demands. In this case, the mechanism of grievances procedures inside organizations was advertised by professionals, especially personnel, HR, and similar professional groups as an effective way to respond and, so to speak, manage such concern, right? And she, of course, then she uses the okay. I don't know where I'm going with this, but that's, I think, all I had to say.
What I found interesting is when she sort of identifies a challenge of different perspectives, like in page 410, institutional theories challenge the notion of an objective rationality. So what she's talking about is essentially the conflict between structural approaches and institutionalized approaches, which opens the door for a lot of conflict when it comes to implementation. Institutional theories challenge the notion of an objective rationality, arguing that concepts of rationality are socially constructed by non-market factors such as widely accepted norms and patterns of behavior, citing Meyer and Rowan explicitly. These belief systems appear rational in that they specify in a rule-like manner what organizations must do to be efficient, but they are myths in that their efficacy depends on the fact that they are widely shared rather than inherently correct. And then she goes on from there to talk about how the literature on law and organizations raises the possibility of agency and organizational response to law, but does not specify how institutional processes and agency might coexist. And so she's laying out some of the arguments about how, say, organizations seek to act rationally but are constrained by their institutional environment. We can think about organizations within an industry are trying to perhaps do something different than what the industry is what are industry norms, but the industry norms get in the way. And second, institutional environments influence market rationality. In other words, the social valuation of institutionalized structures affects their benefits to organizations. Now, I was trying to think about a good example or a plain speak version of that. Can someone help me out?
Yeah, so I like the line she uses where she says that it's local rationality within the context of global institutionalism. And for me, I think part of what's so appealing about is a struggle that I and my classmates had as graduate students when we first encountered institutional theory, which is to say, we're presented when we read institutional theory with this sharp contrast between efficiency theories and institutional theories. And I actually think this particular paper, so Edelman et al. 1999, has a great, very concise sort of contrast in those two paragraphs you were citing, Tom. But in fact, when you think about an organizational perspective, they are trying to think strategically. And the ways in which they navigate these institutional pressures are strategic ways, right? You shouldn't picture them as being sort of, in some sense, stupid, right? And just doing things because the next guy over did them. They're trying to make smart decisions about how to operate, but they're doing this within a context of socially constructed beliefs about the right way to do things. And so it's that balance between strategic, sort of efficiency-oriented local behavior and a broader global context of institutionalized, socially constructed beliefs that I think allows Edelman to advance this story. Is that what you were getting at?
Yes, it was. And I really appreciate it. It's a struggle sometimes because usually when I think about how I apply institution theory, I like to use the speed limit as the good example, because there's an example of where you can have a law that says that the speed limit's going to be 55, but then norms and enforcement and all of that stuff sort of come into play, and suddenly not only are people ordinarily driving 65, but eventually the speed limit goes up to 70, 75, depending on where you are, you know, that sort of a thing. And I was trying to find that, how do I understand what she was trying to get at with that one particular sentence?
Yeah. So I think that just to lay out the argument of this paper, I think the core claim is the one that we've already cited, which is that market rationality can follow rationalized myth. Right? You can start with something that's a rationalized myth, and it can ultimately be institutionalized to such an extent that it becomes truly or purely rational to follow that myth. And so she starts in a similar place to where she starts the first article, which is the law is ambiguous. Organizations construct compliance. They construct compliance in this way that we were just talking about, where they're trying to be rational. In this case, there's not much institutionalized yet. And so they're looking to the professional literature to try and understand how to construct that visible compliance. But then the extension that this paper offers is how those compliance strategies that they construct then become accepted by the courts. The courts sanction those practices. And as a result of the fact that courts say these practices are legitimate, this is the right way to go if you want to be in compliance with the law, it then actually becomes rational and efficient to adopt those policies. So even though at first it was a myth and ceremony approach to navigating uncertainty, through the institutionalization in the law, it becomes rational and efficient. One of the things I love about this paper is the creative use of data, particularly because in my own historical work, you're often triangulating across different data sources in order to really make the case for the story you're trying to tell. But one of the things she shows is that these grievance procedures were proposed by professionals as the right way to respond to these new legal pressures. And the story that was told was that these grievance procedures were going to protect the organization from complaints. They were going to make employees basically feel heard. That's not her language. It's a little anachronistic, but it was going to make them feel heard internally and therefore result in fewer complaints. And it was also going to protect those organizations legally. If those complaints do end up in the courts, organizations could put forward, oh, well, we have this grievance procedure, and the courts would say, oh, then you're good. And what she shows is that these actually don't work. Right? So organizations that have grievance procedures do not experience a significantly smaller number of external lawsuits. They don't experience a significantly smaller number of internal complaints. If anything, they get more complaints. And so she shows in this way, you know, it's a tough argument to sort of prove statistically, but she shows we have no reason to believe that this was efficient when it was proposed. Instead, it was proposed as part of this social construction of compliance by the professional groups. But then she shows gradually how the courts came to accept this, even though at first they resisted this argument. They said, yeah, that's not really going to cut it. You're still liable. Over time, they started to accept this as a legitimate defense, and therefore it became sort of efficient for organizations to adopt.
One thing that you mentioned is an interesting one that we should unpack as we continue through, is the conception of what do we mean by something working. Because indeed, ultimately, there's like two levels of what works, you know, or what we may mean by something working here. There's the ultimate end, which is the reduction of a discrimination, which is something that's really, really hard to measure. And so what we're essentially dealing with here is a whole series of proxy indicators, I guess, you know, so substitute indicators. And Edelman lists them. You know, basically, as she explains the myth, one measure of efficacy is the impact on number of external complaints. Another one is impact on overall number of internal complaints, and that may also generate external complaints by making employees more aware of their rights or by encouraging internal complaints, but then failing to provide satisfactory resolutions. So an odd thing I think happens here is that, you know, on the one hand, at the one level, the ultimate end goal, you actually want complaints to go up because that's what should draw greater attention and provide a greater path to success in the overall goal. But of course, that's not what was presented by the professionals. I don't know if this was necessarily part of the intention behind the article, but I think it is kind of interesting to think about how this sort of shows that the, you know, going after a short-term or one rather localized mode of efficiency loses sight over the bigger picture.
I mean, one thing that is happening here, right, and she mentions in passing that, of course, one can imagine there are different solutions for the problem. And this is basically about language, right? Different groups are going to vie for control of a jurisdiction. We just had another episode on Abbott, right? And this is happening. So the different groups are going to propose and define the problem in a particular way, which I think adds something also to the institutional idea that to whom and who is advancing a particular myth that it becomes taken for granted, right? So there's this level. The other level I think it is interesting is that I wrote here in my notes is a wonderful example of how the word is really socially constructed, right? And sometimes unintended consequences get on the way here, right? Because if you repeat something long enough by enough people and you cement that ideas in structures and discourses and the available vocabulary and tools that are being sold literally and taken up organizations, then it becomes the way that everyone does it. And in this case becomes, of course, sanctioned by the court at some point, right? So you end up with a particular version of a solution that has come to be taken for granted. And then, of course, becomes even harder to not just, as you're saying, reconsider whether this such tool is getting to our main goal in the first place, but it's because there is already an infrastructure in place, which is assumed to do that.
I love the point that you made, Tom, that there's working for the organization and there's working for society, right? And an increase in complaints is not working for the organization, but it is perhaps working for society, right? If you presume that there are high levels of discrimination already, then having a large number of complaints suggests that people are empowered, right? There's an empirical question here, right? We also have this when we talk about sexual harassment complaints. Does an increased number of sexual harassment complaints indicate an increase in sexual harassment? Or does it conversely indicate a better atmosphere in which people feel more comfortable coming forward, right? So actually, you know, most people end up believing that an increase in the number of complaints is actually a good thing because it's holding organizations more accountable for existing sort of relatively high levels of discrimination. But of course, that was not what was advocated by the professionals who advanced this story. And Pedro, picking up on the point about the professional jurisdiction, I love this argument here, and it's one that I think is taken up and done sort of in even greater detail by Dobbin and Kelly in their AJS from 2007, where they show specifically HR and legal departments competing to define what's the right way of responding to the threat of sexual harassment litigation. And they show how the results of that competition are the product of basically how well those two different parties can appeal to leadership, can appeal to the interests of leadership. And HR wins because the solution it proposes looks more tractable and looks like it's going to be more successful, even if it actually, back to Tom's point, doesn't really work very much.
I think another interesting part, especially in the myth of judicial deferral, that that struck my attention was the fact that the law or the legal environment and the judicial environment is influenced by a whole bunch of other things. Like you don't look at the story of a particular law or set of laws in isolation. And the example that struck me was where she brings in the theory of the hostile work environment and the interpretation of or how that theory influenced what the judicial system responded to the presence of grievance procedures. So in this case, it was a theory in which an employee may sue because coworkers' harassing acts make the worst workplace intolerable for the plaintiff. And this is something that became a defense for the plaintiff, who was basically saying that, well, I couldn't exercise the grievance procedure because in order to do so, essentially be telling my boss, and what if my boss, in this particular case, it was the boss who was the one who was conducting the harassment. So it puts the plaintiff in a catch-22. So then here, we're thinking about how when a law is written, and the organizations respond to that. Now, this is a case where it was effectively not a law, but a precedent or a, not sure of the right term, I'm not a lawyer, in which the hostile work environment became a thing on the basis of a judicial decision, which had the same effect on the environment, same effect on organizations having to address it or account for it in their grievance procedures. And in their workplace environment more broadly. It was a good example of how the dynamics of the environment influence the discourse as organizations try to, again, shield themselves from liability, try to address these matters as much internally as possible.
Yeah, sort of picking up where you left off, it's just remarkable how powerful this desire to reduce legal liability is. I mean, this is something that I come back to again and again in my work, is that organizations will end up adopting all sorts of very funny ways of doing things because they either believe that it can help them reduce their legal liability, or because the courts have sort of determined that this is a pathway to defending themselves against allegations of misconduct of various kinds. Great. So, Tom, what else do you think we need to touch on?
Why don't you just, if you could, just give us a quick summary / so what for the, what she concluded in the second article?
Yeah. So, I think we sort of started with this at the top, but I think she draws on these very different kinds of empirical analyses, right? She's doing analyses of professional publications. She's analyzing what's going on within organizations, their use of policies, and also the rates at which they're experiencing internal and external complaints. And then she turns to this analysis in the law as well. And she uses these different analyses in order to build up this argument. And the argument is that organizations start out facing this ambiguous legal environment where they feel pressure to do something to defend themselves against a newly increased threat of liability, right? Thanks to new laws that have made them accountable for new levels of anti-discrimination. And there are no prescriptions in the law, again, going back to the 1992 article, for what exactly they should be doing. And so they construct these modes of compliance. And this article is great because using those professional publications, she really gets into more of the details of how these compliance strategies are constructed and advocated over time. And then she uses a second empirical analysis, the quantitative analysis, to try and suggest that the basis on which these strategies were proposed was actually not really there, right? It was proposed as a way of reducing the number of complaints you were going to get. And at the time it was proposed, it didn't actually reduce the number of complaints that you would get. It might even increase it, right? As we were discussing earlier. And then she turns to the analysis of law to show how at first these proposals were not accepted by the courts, right? So refuting again for the origin of these policies as being rational, she says it wasn't rational for reducing the number of complaints. It wasn't even rational for defending yourself in court, right? At first the court said, no go, this is not going to pass muster as far as a defense. But over time, the courts start to accept this defense, and eventually it becomes institutionalized in the law, and thereby sort of more broadly rational for organizations to adopt. So at first, it's pure myth that this is the right way to respond to the legal environment. And through this process of institutionalization, through the endogenous development of these legal regulations, we end up in a place where the law actually does provide true incentives for organizations to adopt these policies. And from there, even more organizations are expected to adopt them.
I want to say many things, but they're all in part true. So I'm eager to get there.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.